Section 3. Impact. Module 11. Impact and Influences Today. Key points. Mises argues that, by providing the cushion of a lender of last resort, central banks encourage inflation and free banks from the stringent discipline of the market. Mises's typology of money has been very influential, and two of his definitions are currently used by central banks to count aspects of the money supply. After the 2008 financial crisis, the U.S., U.K., and Eurozone nations all engaged in massive quantitative easing. Critics used Mises' arguments to warn against this. Position. In The Theory of Money and Capital, Ludwig von Mises is extremely skeptical of fractional reserve banking, which leads to the expanding circulation in the economy of money substitutes. Fiduciary media. These are only partly backed by what Mises views as actual money. The excessive expansion of money substitutes leads to destructive cycles of expansion and contradiction in the economy. Booms and busts. Mises's arguments are especially relevant in examining how the world's central bankers have established a series of rules governing contemporary fractional banking, and how those rules have been applied. These global banking regulations continue to change and are in flux at the moment. Fractional reserve banking and other parts of modern banking practices, like the issuing of banknotes, emerged in the 17th century, particularly in London. Merchants stored their gold in private vaults with goldsmiths, who began lending the money out. These goldsmiths issued promissory notes that evolved into banknotes. In 1695, the Bank of England began issuing the first banknotes. These were at first handwritten, then replaced by printed standardized ones by 1745. Fractional banking arose when banks realized depositors would not usually ask for their money at the same time, which in turn suggested that it was necessary for banks to hold liquid reserves equivalent only to some portion of their total deposits. When banks got these calculations wrong, however, the new practice could cause serious panics. For example, Britain experienced a currency crisis in 1797 when too many worried depositors asked to withdraw their money in gold or silver, that is, in specie or bullion. As a result, governments increasingly created central banks, or gave an existing bank the powers of a central bank, to issue rules about the reserves banks need to hold, and act as a lender of last resort if any private bank faced a run on its deposits. These began with the Banque de France in 1800, the Bank of England after the Bank Charter Act of 1844, and the U.S. Federal Reserve after the Federal Reserve Act in 1913. Most economists view central banks as an important break on the inflationary tendencies of private banks. Mises, however, makes a provocative argument. Central banking frees banks from the stringent restraints imposed on their activities by the market, and by providing the cushion of a bank of last resort, stimulates and propels banks into inflationary expansion of their loans and deposits. Interaction. In 1974, the world's 10 largest central banks established a forum in Switzerland called the Basel Committee on Banking Supervision to frame worldwide rules about capital adequacy. How much money, capital, a bank should hold compared with its liabilities. Mises opposed all fractional reserve banking. None of these reforms have gone so far as Mises would have preferred, and imposed full reserve banking, which is to say, banking where reserves are at least equal to the sum of all liabilities. Modern reforms have only tried to limit fractional reserve banking and regulate it. In each case, the world's central bankers, gathering in Basel, have been guided by worries about risks involved in fractional reserve banking, very familiar to readers of the theory of money and credit. The first Basel Accord, called Basel I, was issued in 1988. Under this agreement, different bank assets were given different amounts of credit risk. Cash, bullion, and home country treasury debt each have no risk, while residential mortgages have 50% risk, and most business debt has 100% risk weight. Basel I says banks have to hold capital equal to 8% of their risk-weighted assets, which is each asset multiplied by its individual risk weight. After the global financial crisis of 2008, new requirements were released in Basel III, further raising the amounts of capital banks have to hold. They now need to hold 27% of their liabilities in so-called Tier 1 capital. Even firmer banking standards were negotiated in 2016 and 2017, called Basel IV. Mises's insight, there are different types of money, has also had strong influence on how economists measure the types of money in circulation. For example, for the U.S. Federal Reserve, M0, the narrowest measure of money supply, counts all physical currency, including coinage. M1 also includes accounts which can quickly be drawn on, like checking and current accounts. M2, often thought of as money held by households, include savings accounts, retail funds, and small certificates of deposit. M4 is the broadest measure, including government treasury bills and short-termed unsecured business debt, called commercial paper. In November 2017, there was $3.62 trillion of M1 money in circulation. Going up merely to M2, this increased to $13.79 trillion. Mises would have argued that the money supply of the United States was only $3.62 trillion. However, the fact official economists keep such close track of each type of money owes strongly to his typology in theory of money and credit. The continuing debate. Following the 2008 financial crisis, the United States, United Kingdom, and the Eurozone engaged in quantitative easing as an unconventional way of increasing money supply. Quantitative easing, an attempt to expand the money supply and thereby stimulate economic growth and lower unemployment, is likely where Mises's thought is now most relevant. Mises provides arguments to be careful of excessive growth in money supply. In fact, Mises only favors growth in the money supply when new mining deposits are discovered. Most economists now accept his arguments that inflation occurs when money supply grows faster than the economy as a whole, reducing money's value as a medium of exchange. Ordinarily, central banks expand money supply by lowering interest rates, by buying short-term government bonds. However, this is not possible when interest rates are already at or near zero, the case for the U.S. and Europe after 2008. To take the U.K. as an example, interest rates were 5.7% in July 2007, but by March 2009 had been cut to 0.5%, their lowest since the creation of the Bank of England in 1694. They remained at 0.5% or below for 8 years afterwards. Quantitative easing stimulates an economy growing at a slow rate when interest rates already are at or near zero. Here, central banks buy government debt, treasury bonds, corporate debt, bonds, and mortgage debt, mortgage-backed securities. In the U.S., the Federal Reserve engaged in the first round of quantitative easing in late 2008, a second called QE2 in late 2010 and early 2011, while a third, QE3 or QE Infinity, stretched from late 2012 to late 2014. Mises is a sharp critic of expansion of the money supply. However, the then-governor of the Bank of England, Mervyn King, argued in late 2011 the money supply was actually in danger of shrinking. Quantitative easing counteracted this shrinking, said King, on the basis that most of the money in our economy, broad money, comprises liabilities of banks in the form of bank deposits. When banks reduce the size of their balance sheet and deleverage, he explained, they are reducing not just the size of their assets, but the size of their liabilities. That is to say, the money in circulation. Mises's precautions were never far from the lips of opponents of quantitative easing, including the Financial Times, which argued central banks were trapped in a cycle of QE forever, and ended by quoting Mises. End of Section 3, Module 11. Coming up next, Section 3, Impact, Module 12. Where next?